When your team sees that you are also human and you too have feelings and maybe you don't know what to do at a given moment, they might actually rally around you because they want to follow a leader that's more like them than someone who is kind of a step function away in how they deal with things.
Welcome to the RH Podcast. We talk about business, software, and everything in between. Visit us at www.recursive.house, where we build software for large and small businesses. Hi, Thomas. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
Great. This is Thomas J. Salon. He's a graduate from the University of Berkeley, California. For over 23 years, he's been in the technology industry in various capacities. Software designer for over 13 years and a managing for over 9 years. And currently, he's the director of engineering at Microsoft. So nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you here too. It's a privilege to be here.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to start off with some soft, nice, easy questions. One question, since you've been at Microsoft for a reasonable amount of time, is what's your favorite thing at working at Microsoft?
Oh, that's a great question. The favorite thing I think about working at Microsoft is that it gives me a feeling of being in a small company, even though it sounds cliche. I like the fact that when I go to work, I work with a small group of people most of the time, and they have come to really mean a lot to me, more than just colleagues and coworkers. Even though Microsoft has got over 100,000 people all over the world, it doesn't feel like that when I go to work. And that's something I look forward to when I go to work, when I go to the office, when I'm driving to work. I'm looking forward to seeing people, not just the projects that I have to work with.
So is that something you went out of your way to curate for yourself? Or is that sort of a cultural thing that happens throughout the organization?
It's a cultural change, I think, that's been emphasized more, especially over the last 10 years in the company. I worked in this company for over 23 years, like you said. It's not to say that things were totally different when I first joined the company, but there has been a lot more emphasis on culture, working with people, how you make others feel when you interact with them, more than just, hey, have you shipped this? Have you checked in this code? Have you released on time? Yeah, that stuff is still important, but just as important is how you work with people and the, you know, the impact you have and creating the culture in the team.
So, you know, you talked a little bit about the people. What is your favorite part when it comes to working with technology? What do you like the most about that?
Technology always keeps me on my toes. Just when I'm comfortable with something, lo and behold, news comes out that what I'm doing is maybe the second most interesting thing now because something cool has just come out. If you've been paying, anyone's been paying attention, they'll probably think, well, the thing I've heard this year a lot is ChatGPT, artificial intelligence. And guess what? That wasn't most of my career. Almost entirely, my career has been about something that doesn't seem that cool now because artificial intelligence, deep learning, machine learning, supervised learning, that's a big part of what's interesting. But what is interesting also is AI isn't just about algorithms and, you know, right, creating these trees, decision trees, pruning. AI is much more than that. AI is engineering as much as it is about theoretical computer science. But that's just an example of what makes my job interesting is, you know, you can spend a lot of time specializing in something only to realize you've got to keep your skill set constantly polished and you've got to be interested in learning and finding out about things you don't know.
I agree with that 100%, especially with what we're doing. You know, it's always interesting. We have people that, you know, they have different concerns at every junction, and every concern requires a different kind of solution, different kind of technology. And that puts us on our toes, like almost at every engagement, every interaction. And that's something some people find a little bit, they can find that to be a little bit tough. But, you know, it can also be sort of exciting if you're, you know, the kind of person that technology, if you're the kind of person that gets bored easily, you won't have to worry. You're in sort of in the right area. Working in technology so long, you probably have seen it affect people's lives in different ways over the years. So what's your perspective on that? And, you know, how does that affect you? And how have you seen that affect other people? You know, do you have any sort of any perspective on that?
That's the thing about Microsoft, which I think is magical. You know, Microsoft is, I think, right now the second most valuable company by market cap in the world, at least in the US. So you get to be in a very unique position in industry to easily make an impact on what might be like a whole continent's worth of people, and sometimes a whole world. I've been in a situation where I was walking down this terminal in Heathrow Airport and I saw a kiosk and I realized that's my code. That's my team's code that's running. So that's amazing in Microsoft, is that you get to really influence and make an impact on customers. That comes both ways. So if you don't do your job right, or you've got a problem or a bug that ships, you are going to hear about it. And sometimes the customers will not pull any punches, just depending on what you work on. Recently, I worked on a project that impacted screen time for families to control how much time their kids can use PCs or devices. And that wasn't working properly. And all of a sudden, parents, you know, had difficulty for a short period of time unlocking the devices for their kids. And so that's an example of customer impact that goes both ways. If you do your job right, you really feel proud of the work. If you don't do it, you know, the responsibility is on you to make it right quickly. And so we focus a lot on making sure we stay connected, we focus on quality, and we have to be vigilant at all times.
So, you know, this also sort of segues into my next question, which is, you know, there's a lot of responsibility and there's a lot of consequence with almost everything that you're doing. So how do you manage how people feel about you? Like, how do you see yourself within this sort of landscape of the consequences of your actions or the consequences of what you're doing? One thing is for sure when it comes to public perception is that we live in a world where people are less and less inhibited in telling you how they feel about what you're doing. And, you know, for better or worse, it's good feedback, but it's definitely blatant. So how do you manage that in your own sort of space?
I think as I reflect on some of my experiences, there's two parts to it. One is, how do I think about how my team watches me and responds to maybe a crisis or a challenging situation? Maybe in my earlier part of my career, I would spend more time thinking about that. As I kind of travel down the career and spend more years Microsoft with different projects, different teams, I've just realized it's as important to be authentic, not just saying the right words, but actually being vulnerable. I think Brené Brown talks about vulnerability. You see a lot of famous leaders in the industry, but it's very big step for you as a person, me as a person, in a position of leadership or responsibility to feel vulnerable and then say how vulnerable you are. So, for instance, if there was a challenging situation at work or with customers or with partners, sometimes it's just fine to say, hey, you know what, that sucks. That just doesn't make me feel good. I'm not even sure what to say. I'm quite speechless. Whatever it is, as much as it is to try to comfort your team, when your team sees that you are also human and you too have feelings and maybe you don't know what to do at a given moment, they might actually rally around you because they want to follow a leader that's more like them than someone who is kind of a step function away in how they deal with things. And then on a personal level, it's also important to realize not everything is your fault. Even if it is your fault, you realize you just have a misstep. You've got to take a step away and you've got to deal with it yourself. You've got to be honest about it, that there are times when you might be burnt out, even as a leader. You don't have to project a picture of perfection to your team. You don't have your team to see you soldiering away and, you know, for them to see you as this person who is going to shoulder and single-handedly carry them through the hill. If you're honest with yourself, you need to check out for a bit, have a little bit of space, reflect, spend time with your family and come back. That kind of authentic human behavior will really help cope with things that come up. And I've been trying to do more of that than, say, I have done over the last 5 years or before.
And I agree that I think, you know, I guess there has always been a lot of pressure to sort of not necessarily hide, but, you know, delay, you know, what's going on in general. I think most people have felt that way before, but I think there's definitely a lot of value in just being very honest about what's going on and then allowing your team to sort of react to that in a way that I think it kind of almost improves efficiency, because if they know what's going on, they know how to react to that. They know that they should react to that. And then that cycle is very fast. And especially if it's a small team, you know, and you've definitely built a little bit of trust, they can say, okay, we know what's going on. We know you're doing your best. Let's see how we can help you move forward as, you know, as people who actually want to support you. And I think that has a lot of value, actually. It really does. And it's some people think about it like being open is sort of a kind of like a trick, but it's more of a, I think of it more like as a way to be actually efficient, because people respond to how other people feel faster than any PowerPoint you could ever make. And I think that has a lot of value.
Actually become more efficient. Exactly. Like you said, it's amazing how many people are quietly modeling themselves after you. When you are in a position of leadership or a position, I really mean myself here. I may not realize how many people are potentially even modeling themselves by copying me. So when there's a crisis, when there's a problem, and I choose not to take a break, I choose not to take a vacation day, I just want to churn right through it, they might realize they have to do the same thing. And so they don't feel comfortable disconnecting when it might be the right thing to do. And now they're burning through the midnight oil, they're spending late nights, and they don't become efficient, they don't become happy. And at the end of the day, the work doesn't get done on time, or if it does get done, at a steep cost. And so that is just a cascading effect of, you know, results that ultimately, you know, can really hurt the team.
Exactly. And it's a lot of, also, you know, about managing, especially when you're talking about sort of taking rest and then doing work. There's a lot of, you know, the idea of managing focus has become really, really popular now, but it's only as believable as your leadership allows you to do that. And I think, you know, if leadership is able to model that, like, sort of philosophy, they're more likely to actually have it than any PSA or anything. It's, you know, people do what, you know, children do what their parents do, know what they say. I think it's popular with children, but it's true in general. It's just people are less willing to admit that adults are also copying other adults, maybe. I think that's a good insight, and I think that's a good point. I wanted to ask you, just in general, how do you feel about empathy in the workplace? We talked a bit about, you know, people copying other people or people copying leaders and how that sort of affects the way they work. I mean, that's sort of like one aspect of how you lead people. But I think if we're talking a little bit about empathy in general, and then being able to be able to perceive how people see each other, how does that permeate in a workplace? And then to what degree is that or isn't that sort of how you want to push people forward or push people back, maybe?
I was thinking about this incident I read in Satya's book. So Satya wrote a book called Hit Refresh a few years ago, and he gave this great example of a mistake he made and how that sort of brought about the subject of empathy. I think he had an interview with an interviewer, and the person decided to ask him, "Hey, Satya, imagine you see a baby on the road crying." And I'm paraphrasing this. You've got to read the book to get the literal account of this. Yeah, you see a baby crying on the road. What are you going to do? And he said that he answered properly and correctly, "I'm going to call 911. And the interviewer said, "Hey, Satya, that's a baby. Maybe you should just pick up the baby." and so that, you know, that really brought up this idea about empathy. And he gave that as an example of what empathy is and how different it can change the way you respond. And that constantly comes up in my head, that empathy is not something you can exercise by training and trying to be empathetic. Empathy is about doing less. It's about thinking less and going back to what you are as a human being. And I'm not great at it. You know, as a person, I'm constantly learning how to stop being corporate or how to, you know, step up and kind of cloak my answers with the right answers. Every day when I talk to my team members and when they're asking me for help, empathy is about not just answering the question, but about questioning why they asked that question. What is it behind them that led them to ask? And then maybe arriving at a different answer. So if, for example, you know, a person is asking, hey, Thomas, I need 2 more weeks to finish this project. My first response might be, can you explain what's the reason for the 2 weeks, where the shortcut is? Can we finish it in the same time, but maybe getting help from another team? Or, you know, do we need me to talk to partners? Or should we try to do it in 1 week, going down the negotiation route? What if empathy isn't used? I would be going down this train of thought. But if I take a step back and say, why is this person asking for 2 weeks? What's going on? What's behind this question? And go a little bit deeper. Maybe the question comes up from the fact that they need some time away. They need to deal with a coworker on their team that's having challenges that they don't necessarily feel like requires escalation. Or there is a personal issue at play that they're not able to articulate. They actually need time off to be away. So the right answer might be that, you know, we need to let them take that time off and reassign this project. Whatever the answer is, empathy is about trying to get to the root of the issue and speaking human to human more than you normally do. That's simply a skill, or perhaps it's that humanity that I think we as leaders constantly grapple with. How much humanity do we show? How much strength and leadership and maybe ruthlessness or decisiveness do we need to show? And what's the right balance? How do we do that?
What's interesting to me is, like, in that moment, right? So, you know, an unflattering view of leadership is a mix of cognitive load and stress. And a little bit of that is you're having all these things happen and everybody's concerns weighed on you as you're moving forward. How do you take that all away and give your own mind space to allow that sort of feeling or that sort of perspective to come in, right? Because there are, for every question you get, there are 10 other questions that pop up that some might consider to be more important, but not in that moment. They're just more important overall and are pressing over the time of your all the things that you're doing. But how do you get that to not crowd out your mind and sort of like focus on this person and sort of not react to it in the way that you kind of react, be reacting to everything else that day to some degree?
It's very easy to have this knee-jerk reaction. For every question is asked, maybe especially as leaders who worked in the industry for 10, 20 years, you likely know a similar question that someone asked 5 years ago. So you likely know, based on that, you can harness your experience and start firing away the right plan of action and just go down a certain road. But it turns out, the more you spend time with people, the more I've spent time, the more I've realized every situation is unique. And that's a cliche. It's true. When you say that, it sounds cliche. What's more interesting, though, is that every situation requires me to ask more questions and have fewer answers. I spend more time today compared to, say, 10 years ago as a more junior leader. I realize I need to keep asking questions when someone asks me questions. And someone comes to me with a problem and try to turn this around and help them steer the ship themselves instead of me taking over as captain and saying, look, we got to go down this road. Now, this is tricky because you could go down that new road that I just suggested and take it to an extreme and say, well, I'm just going to keep asking questions. And that might not necessarily be the right way if you just almost take it to an extreme. But what I'm saying is that we've got to move that needle from being the person providing all the answers to the person that's asking more questions. Balance that as leaders with being accountable, because as leaders, we are also accountable for progress, for impact, for results. We've got to have results. So when someone comes to us with a challenge, at the end of the day, we need a plan. We need to move from the point we're at to a better place. But to get to that better place, we have to co-captain the ship with the person who's coming to us with the problem and kind of guide them and say, here, you stay on. You press on. I'm here to help you steer the ship, but you're going to get through this problem with my help.
So, you know, we've been sort of dancing around sort of the idea of assisting others. And I want to sort of bring it down to something super concrete so people can latch on to that. And what I want to ask is, you know, when someone comes to you with a problem, what's the first thing you think?
There is a training that I took a few years ago that really resonated with me. And I wanted to share that here. It's called The Coaching Habit. It's by Michael Bungay Stanier. I hope I didn't butcher his name. Michael Stanier, and it's easily found on search on the internet. What I love about this training is how it turns the dynamics of a conversation around. From now, any conversation has a person, at least a type of conversation like this at work, often consists of two people where one person is bringing a problem to another person with the hopes that that person will give answers. That's usually how it sets up. And in a situation where someone is coming to me, what the coaching habit challenges me to do is to say, well, Thomas, I know you are just bursting with advice. You've got 23 years of experience. I mean, you could just run rampage here with the amount of spectacular advice you could give, because you've got experience as a leader, experience writing code, experience building stuff, making impact, working in a big, powerful company like Microsoft, the tremendous worldwide impact. It's a household name. You've been working in a company like this. You've got advice that people would sit down and listen to you like a guru. Yes, but don't stop. Don't. And that's what it tells you. Take a pause. Put the advice monster in you aside. Really, he actually loves using this term, advice monster. Put it aside and start asking questions. And so this class, this training talks about what key questions you can ask and that will kind of elicit responses that will start the dynamics of the conversation and start steering it towards the person asking the question and saying, I trust you. You came to me for help, but I'm trusting you. I know you can do this. And if you take this class, Michael talks a lot about the research that went into this idea. There's a lot of cognitive research, scientific studies that this is based upon, that when someone comes to you for help, it isn't a binary thing. You don't have to help by answering the question directly, face to face. You turn this around, ask key questions. And one of the key questions you ask is, what's the greatest challenge here for you? What is it? Let's work on this together and continue asking questions like that. You get surprising results. And that's really been the focus. I have really believed in this as I started pushing on this, even for my own one-on-ones and conversations.
In terms of when I'm engaging with people, I don't think anyone has ever told me the problem that actually mattered, not because they didn't want to, but just because it just wasn't the problem. They've always had sort of what they presented as the issue. And the issue was maybe, I would even say, it's a month and maybe 23 questions away, you know, sort of in a different sort of side of things. But in a one-on-one context, it means something different. But in our context, it's always, let's, you know, you've told us what you want. Let's really investigate, you know, if we were to like sort of solve your problem very quickly, what would that look like? And then in order to make that happen, it's a month of searching or even more. And it's always interesting, the journey. I've never had an experience where it's exactly where I thought it was. It's never there. So that's always been very interesting to watch.
Yeah, 23 questions away.
Yeah.
How can you find the right questions and let those thoughts dance in their minds? Get them thinking, get them realizing, oh, you know what? Oh, this is actually broken down into a slightly different thing that here to kind of help me start ruminating about and realizing that.
It does sound like your philosophy is do not give advice, ask questions. That's what it really sounds like. And I think that's, you know, to put it sort of succinctly, is sort of where you're pushing forward with. And I think that's very fair.
Too strong to say do not give advice as much as push back on the first urge that comes to you. It's going to be about giving advice. There might be advice that you really do have to give sometimes. But before getting there, have that dynamic between you and that person. Try to get them to think. Try to get them to answer these questions. And yes, at some point, we all know when the time is right to give advice. What we want to do before that is to not turn it into a conversation that's dominated by myself giving that advice, just that advice. Yeah,
you know, within that context, you're really giving power to that person to, you know, figure out the space of their problem and see where your experience can interject and guide them in the right direction. But only when you've you or yourself have sort of given them that opportunity, to present you as full a picture as possible in that sort of space, because you're giving them, as Queen, or quite a lot of, I want to say power, but really opportunity. You still have a situation where you still have to set expectations and limits and things of that nature. So sort of with that sort of flipped dynamic that most people, I think most people are not familiar with that flipped dynamic, and it can be kind of daunting for leadership because there are expectations that need to be met. How do you continue to build or maintain trust in the way that you're still comfortable with?
Earlier part of what you just said about expectations, absolutely right. And that's what makes the job difficult as leaders, is we're not just here as people who are giving advice, as say a therapist or you know, a psychologist might be the case. Although that's a big part of the role, is that you want to be a person that has empathy. You talked about empathy earlier, is a person who listens, but you are also a leader. You're working in a company that has results to accomplish, work to do, and customers to work with, right? So we have to be accountable as leaders. We ultimately need results. Results matter. Especially if you're working in a company that, you know, trades in the stock market, or if it doesn't. In fact, in many situations outside of the corporate world, results still matter. Results matter even if you're working as a priest in a church. So you've got to be accountable to results. And the conversation, and that's what makes this coaching habit so interesting, is that it's rooted in you turning the dialogue back to the person and asking questions, but it's also rooted in being accountable. So one of the things you do in that structure that he breaks it down into is not just asking questions, but to steer this person into action and accountability. So one of the questions you travel through that dialogue is, what are the next steps? What are we going to do as the result of this conversation? And when are we going to do it by? So setting that framework ensures that you not only had this kind of productive exchange where you help that person understand the problem better themselves, but they're also going to do certain things, certain finite things in this finite time window.
I think the obvious question from there, if that continues to run on, what happens? How do you deal with that? Because there are people that do that. You know, they take advantage of that opportunity to no longer provide as much value as you would hope. And some people are convincing at that, right? And it is a complex thing to just, you know, especially when you have large amounts of people that you're dealing with, to figure out if that's true or if that's not true. So I think that's something I'd like to get your feedback on, because that's challenging for almost everybody.
It's the roles you play as a leader where you are accountable for both the end result and the journey you get, the journey you take with that person, which in sometimes in engineering, we talk about the what and the how. We are responsible for both. We've got to be responsible for the how, making sure the journey is calm and for the most part, a journey that's, you know, sensible and is built on the right framework in the right team setting. So in other words, you and your team, you have an understanding, and through the culture that you've created are accomplishing your goals in an environment that is positive, flourishing, that is sustaining, good morale, well-being, all of these things. Now, no matter what you do, there is always going to be the possibility of actors or people in the team that may take advantage of it or may simply just not do well, no matter what you do, no matter what type of team. And that's not our fault. That's the choices we make. That's the choices they make to work in the team. Or it might be the result of a fit. For some of us, the team that we've chosen to work in may not have the right project or the environment that we like for a variety of reasons. And that's totally fine. But what it means is that there is a good possibility, or there's a small possibility, that no matter what type of team or environment you set up, there could be one or two people that just are not delivering results. That's where you talk about the what, the results, the outcomes, the impact you and your team are ultimately accountable for. And that's something that has to be seen and objectively as possible. And we talk a lot about culture. In fact, I'm looking at it almost in reverse order, where we spend a lot of time creating a positive culture, but we must not forget that we are accountable for results. And when it's time to evaluate results, we want to make sure that we understand whether or not this person or persons have delivered the impact that they are expected to deliver in that time window. And if they don't, that's something we have to be fair about. Not, if we are not fair about that, we're not going to do justice for the people that are delivering results. So people often come at it from the other angle where we talk about results too much and we don't talk about the journey. You know, we are ruthless about making sure you deliver results, you make sure you do things on time, but we don't care how you do it. You can burn the midnight oil and, you know, you can enslave yourselves and work weekends. I'm looking at it almost the opposite, where if that's one type of problem where you should make sure that you don't do that and you create a healthy atmosphere, healthy culture on your team. But you should also make sure when you create a healthy culture on your team and a flourishing place, that you also hold your team accountable. That creates a healthy relationship between you and your team, that they understand that in the place that they work with, they are still expected to do the job that they're paid to do, that they're expected to deliver results. And you as a job, is your manager, your job as a manager is to coach and help them and ultimately provide direction about how well they're doing.
Right. And I think, you know, you talked sort of, you know, about culture and sort of expectations. And I think I really, you know, sort of appreciate that part of it, at least for us. It's, you know, everything is very, very team-based. So even conversations about how outcomes or the results of efforts and the outcomes of those are relative to how that affected the team and how the team is able to perform as a consequence of your contribution. And, you know, it's never about the individual sort of contribution. It's about how, what that has done to the team. And I think that's super important in making sure that outcomes are tied to the ultimate result, even in the individual conversation where you're trying to help them contribute to the overall arching result, even within that conversation. And I think, and then all, you know, sort of the way that we talk about empathy before in the first half of this, where we're trying to make sure we're empathetic. We are empathetic to their perspective as individuals. We're empathetic because we know that the team needs to take care of you. And we want to make sure that you also are able to contribute so you can take care of the team. I think that's sort of how we sort of bring our culture together. And if you are a person who has good intentions, I think that there will always be a fit for you within that dynamic. And if, you know, your intentions are not the most positive, then it's going to be difficult for you no matter where you are. But as long as those intentions are good and we can see that, then I think we can work with that regardless of your skill set. And, you know, if you don't have it, then you don't have it. And there's not much you can do from there. But we can definitely have a respectful conversation about that sort of thing and that perspective, right? And I think that's completely fair for all leaders, you know, in terms of sort of attacking the issue of the outcome with still being able to manage the individual and their personal needs, because they are people and they are important and they are part of the team and they do matter. So I do agree with sort of how you're sort of presenting that. And I think it has a lot of value and it's really hard. It's genuinely difficult. And it is quite a nuanced thing.
I mean, I've worked with so many people in my career. So many names come to mind of people who are simply just not doing great in the team that they were at. They came to me, we've had this conversation, performance wasn't meeting expectations. And these are nice people with just people you'd want to be friends with, you'd invite them home to dinner. They were just not doing that. And so it's on us to be able to have the right conversation about impact, delivering results, not delivering results. And then potentially steer them to a place where they could do well. Not your team, it turns out, but why don't you help them to be at the place where they can be successful? And in many cases, they've turned it around by changing the place they worked or changing something else about the situation they were in, turned the story around the next year into a great outcome, great results.
One of the things that's always interesting to me is, you know, with my experience working with people, and I think your ample experience working with people, is most people, I would hope, want to do well. And I'm not sure it's always true, but in my experience, I think most people want to do well. And there are different things in their way. I'd love to ask you, what do you see are the obstacles, not that other people put in front, but they put in front of themselves that you're able to see and guide them through or around or across or help them sort of, you know, break that blockade?
my career has been almost entirely in engineering, software engineering, and I've been a leader mostly with engineers in my team, although not always. There have been other disciplines or skills that have been part of my team. Many of the people that come to me with problems had engineering challenges in front of them that we both discuss and realize, you know, there could be a gap in what's expected for this role and what they're bringing to the table at the moment. But most conversations lead to me realizing the problem is not the skills that are put on the table, the technical skills. It's not even about the people around them that's posing the challenge, but it's about something within themselves that has turned around and posed a problem. It's about the person in the mirror. I'm not just saying this as a report out of the people that have talked to me. I myself, when I kind of count the number of problems I see or things that bother me from a day-to-day basis, it often turns into that man in the mirror. So when we hear this, when I have a one-on-one where someone is coming to me with a problem and we are trying to break this down, for example, the coaching habit is a great idea. But what I've seen through these conversations is often a reflection or self-reflection that needs to happen, that hasn't happened with this person. This person realizes, you know, this is not about this partner missing a deadline and constantly requiring me to follow up with them. This is about this person that is just setting me off. Or this is about me being frustrated that my voice is not heard in a meeting where someone keeps interrupting me. That leads me to be frustrated. That leads me to feeling like no one cares about what I think. So many, many cases come down to a challenge that a person needs help with to change the way they look at something. And I've noticed that it really helps to open a notepad. And for those of you in Windows, you know, Notepad is still my favorite application because it opens up faster than any app. But what I like about it is it's a scratch pad, right? It's literally a sheet of paper online. I noticed that this really helps me. And I've spoken to some of people that I've had conversations with or who have even mentored me. They like to open a document and they just write down what's going on in their head. As you think about this, as you feel frustrated, write down what's going on. What is it that's tugging at you? What's pulling at you? The conversation often steers into what is it that's eating at them? What is it that's really triggering them or provoking them? And ultimately, but how can I realize I may not be able to change the people in front of me, but I can change how I respond or how I can let it get to me or not get to me? And that's an interesting place to get to. That's an interesting secondary conversation to start.
You know, I'd like to share a little bit of a story. We had as a consulting firm, we deal with a lot of people within the technology space, of course. And I've had an experience with an engineer that's very, very talented, but English wasn't his first language. And he tried to be as productive as he could, but there is a limitation. And it's, I always think people who are, you know, producing in a language they're not familiar with are exceptional, sometimes by default. And he wasn't with us, he was with our client. And, you know, when we go in, we try and make people productive and, you know, by example and by assistance. And one thing we were able to sort of help with or unblock was just the way that information was presented to him could have been done in a way where he could understand it, but he didn't necessarily need to know the language. So they were presenting it as essays and, you know, something as simple as putting it in some sort of graph or some sort of table. And it did get him exactly what he needed, sort of without sort of that translation issue where there's just less of a certain kind of information that he's not familiar with for him to focus on. Yeah. And the one that he can't understand, he could focus on. And it's these sort of small tweaks when you give people the opportunity to express themselves, they can present themselves and can really help your team.
And how did it help this person? Did he share?
Yeah, it just helped him because he, you know, something as simple as, you know, a 200 word paragraph or just a page worth of requirements, sort of the logic in between that, if that can just be presented as a table, he understands immediately because a table is a non-language based way of communicating. So because it's just a table, he understands, turn this on, turn this off, this is what we want, and vice versa. And you can even kind of see it where the X's and O's would be. And he says, okay, this is what I need in terms of if and else's. And because of that, that's how I need to make this application, and this is what business wants from me. And I can understand this. I can understand this pretty clearly. And this is sort of of course, on the business side, it's not specific enough. It doesn't really mean anything because what is being turned on and off. But on his side, he already kind of has that context. So all he needs to do is know exactly where those things are, go find them, go switch them on or off. And I think that's all he needs to do within that constraint. And I think that helped him a lot. And that just gave him time and confidence that he can do what he needed to do. So that was something that it was interesting to see. And I also encourage other people to learn how to communicate with him as well, because he had the confidence to do this. He did it. People say, okay, he can do things. Let's make that effort to help him out in that way. Let's make that effort to present it in this way. And I think that just that level of success, that bridge he crossed, I think that kind of heals that piece and continues to move forward, because that builds trust, because you see that someone can do something. And it's always nice to see.
He could be so easy to misunderstand all the things you're seeing from this person and really think, well, this person is not understanding what I'm saying. Maybe I should find somebody who is better, somebody who is smarter or quicker. And so this is a performance problem. This getting more and more common in our industry, because our industry is very inclusive and relatively young and very open just by its nature of being online and remote, inviting people from all over the world. So we tend to bump up with people who are from a different culture, who have a different primary language than ours. And so we are more and more likely to encounter these types of situations, like you said. And so it's really important as leaders to be tuned to that, to understand that, and to have that empathy and figure out from the symptoms or whatever is happening in the workplace, like what is really going on here.
One question I was dodging this whole time, which I think is really important, is, you know, with leadership comes scale, and sort of a lot of these things are interpersonal interactions. And one thing that's always interesting to me is, you know, you have a small core team that you're working with, but somehow whatever you're doing, you have to perceive the outcomes not only in that team, but throughout the organization that you are responsible for. And how do you sort of do that? How do you know what is and isn't working with a feedback loop that, you know, some feedback loops are really about graphs and charts and outcomes and things of that nature, but culture is a little bit of a softer one. It may or may not represent in whatever representation that you have for how organizations are being successful, and it may not be the right way to assess it. So how is that sort of softer skill of saying, okay, this workplace is like this. I am perceiving it as it is, not as it is presented to me. And sort of the small nuances of human interaction that could either be misunderstood or isn't present because you're not in that space. How do you sort of deal with that?
Thanks for bringing this up. This is something that I deal with every day at work. I don't know if I have all the answers, because it was one of the most difficult challenges for me. And even today, when I talk to my manager and ask for help from her, and from others, is how do I get better at that? How do I get better at being more effective at scale and listening and really getting a pulse for whether or not what I'm doing is connecting with the team, or my team has gone in a totally different direction about how effective I am, and I have no idea, and they're just being quiet. As I've gone through this journey, I will tell you first and foremost, I have not perfected it, or I'm not in a position to write a book about this. I have noticed through mistakes that I've done about what works and what doesn't, and I made a lot of this, that number one, I have to be open to feedback. And being open to feedback is not about saying, if you have any feedback, send me an email. That's not what being open to feedback is about. That's a very cliched way of just taking a small step, but not going through with that. Ultimately, and I think you mentioned this earlier in the interviews, about building trust. We've got to build trust, and trust has to happen at a deep foundational level. However, trust is difficult to do if you have a large team that you're managing. It's difficult for you to reach out and create a deep connection with every single person. That's not the goal. The goal is not to be best friends with every single person on the team, but the goal is to create a foundation of trust by looking at the leaders, that I've seen that are reporting to me or that work closely with me, and make creating them as almost as agents for change. It's important to have values that are that matter a lot to you as a leader, and make sure that everyone on the team understands that, understands what's important to you. And that starts with the people closest to you, your staff, the managers or the leaders that are working for you in your team in different capacities. Communicating that is key. Connecting with people at different levels has also been important. If you have a large team of hundreds of people and it's not reasonable to meet with every single person often, meeting with them in different ways, whether it's at a at the coffee machine, or whether it's at a all hands event, or at a smaller scale team events where you meet individual teams at a certain cadence, mixing this up, finding different ways for you to have collisions. I like the word collisions. I think it was Dr. Anita Gray who used this word. Having lots of collision opportunities with people increases the chance that you're going to have a quick but powerful connection with them and have them often. So finding ways to connect, even if you're really far removed, if you're a super high-level leader, finding ways to connect and do that often in different ways helps to keep reinforcing that message. On the other hand, if you spend a lot of time in your room, sort of like this Wizard of Oz type world where you are totally disconnected and you're just sending out edicts and sermons every week or in your team meeting, that's going to go only so far. That's not going to buy connections. That's not going to buy authenticity. And ultimately, it's not going to build long-term trust. So I found that finding more opportunities to intersect, to meet people in different ways, and being clear about what's important to you, what are the values that are important to you, helps to scale up and maybe spread that seeds that you're trying to plant and to build that team that you want, the team that you think would be successful, along with everyone to join you for the ride.
Well, Thomas, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for advising, I think, all the listeners. And I also learned a lot from all the things you sort of told me. And thank you for joining us. Where can people find you? How do they reach out to you?
First of all, thanks so much for having me here too. I really appreciate this time. And you've really made me think a lot about things that have happened over the course of career. Yeah, I hope it's of help to others, and love to hear the feedback too, what they think. What I can learn from others. The easiest way to reach me is on LinkedIn, so please don't hesitate to send me a note or connect. You can find me through my name, Thomas J. Seelan.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Have a good rest of the day.
Welcome to the RH Podcast. We talk about business, software, and everything in between. Visit us at www.recursive.house, where we build software for large and small businesses.